Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life, distributed by Public Media.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Jay Michelson, who's the author of the book God versus Gay? The Religious Case for Equality, a book that came out from Beacon Press just last year. We're talking with Jay by phone today. Jay, how's our connection?
Sounds good to me, Steve.
Ah, you're coming in very clear. Good. And I want listeners to know we're going to be talking about his book, the issues raised in his book. He basically makes the point, and I'm quoting him here, that our shared religious values support full inclusion for gay people. And Jay Michelson himself is of Jewish background, but has an advanced degree in, for example, in New Testament, in addition to several other degrees. He's also been in the news a lot. In fact, just last week he had a full-page article that he authored in Newsweek magazine. That's the March 19, 2012 edition. He was interviewed on CBS TV News this morning, Sunday morning today, the 18th of March. Let's start off with that article, Jay. First of all, what was the issue that caused you to write for Newsweek?
Well, I wrote an article about the Darun Ravi case. This was the bully who spied on his roommate, Tyler Clementi, who later tragically killed himself by jumping off the George Washington Bridge.
And a roommate at Rutgers University.
At Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I think many of us, were obviously horrified by the suicide and, I think, rushed to judgment a little bit. There was a long New Yorker article that filled out a little bit more of the details about Darun Ravi's background, and then there was some additional material and evidence, and I felt that this was actually a really tricky case from a hate crimes perspective. I was also trained as a lawyer in addition to my work in religion, and
you went to Yale Law School.
That's right, and right. It's not just a question of whether Darun Ravi is guilty or innocent of something. We know he's guilty of something. The question was whether he's guilty of a hate crime specifically, and interestingly enough, the jury, which returned a verdict on Friday. Put out pretty much the same kind of mixed judgment that I had arrived at in the Newsweek article, which is also in the Daily Beast, which is to say that there were actually two incidents and they were different, and whether Darun Ravi really had hatred of gay people in his heart as the motivation for those incidents was actually really unclear, and the verdict was mixed as a result, and I think now all eyes are on the judge for sentencing.
Tell us what your main argument was in that piece for people who didn't read it in either the Daily Beast or Newsweek.
So I think, one of the things, and you know this well, Steve, that all of us who are involved in what's sometimes called anti-oppression work, whether we're fighting racism or discrimination or prejudice of any kind, is to recognize that, when you're raised in a culture that has deep prejudice within it, that you don't just get over it. The kinds of attitudes that Darun Ravi sort of evinced in his online communication, and this was very much, I should say, a very 21st century trial. We had a huge body of evidence because Darun Ravi, like many 18-year-olds, he's now 20, but 18 at the time of the crime, had a very large online presence. So we actually had thousands of pages of material that he had written over the years online, and he comes off as I say in the article, kind of as a jerk, as someone who was not necessarily pro-gay, but was certainly not anti-gay in the way that most perpetrators of hate crimes are. So you think of hate crimes, you think about, for example, Matthew Shepard, who was tortured to death, or James Byrd, who was tortured to death, and the people who perpetrated these horrible crimes, which were of course violent crimes, were clearly motivated by homophobia in the first case, racism in the second case. And this was just a lot, this case is a lot grayer. And it's somebody who, it's not a violent crime. It led to violence, of course, self-inflicted violence, but that's not what what Darun Ravi was on trial for. And it seemed to me, I mean, what I say in the article is, you know, Darun Ravi is all of us. And it felt to me as though, you know, he is as a symbol, clearly a symbol for a horrible phenomenon, bullying of LGBT youth. And as a symbol, it would be terrible if he really just got off. That would send exactly the wrong message. But he's also, he's not just a symbol, he's also an individual, he's a human being, and it's not clear that this should really be the test case for hate crimes in general or homophobia in particular.
We're talking about Keeping the Faith with Jay Michelson, author of God versus Gay? The Religious Case for Equality, a book that came out just last year. Listeners are invited to join our conversation. This is a live program heard from Chicago to Indianapolis live over the air, but also heard on podcast. Now, if you're listening live online right now, you may call us a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area, the 217 area code in Illinois, 333-9455 will put you in touch with our technical director, Kyle Crow, and she'll get you in line to talk with our author today, Jay Michelson. I might spell, since there are a lot of different ways to spell Michelson, let me spell his last name, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-S-O-N, Jay Michelson. Jay, thanks again for talking with us. Jay was a guest here at the University of Illinois by a guest of the Hillel Foundation about a month ago, and I had the opportunity to hear him speak to a very diverse and interesting audience there at the Hillel Foundation for Jewish students. Jay, tell us a little bit about your own religious background before we get into the talk about some of the issues in your book.
Sure. So I grew up in the conservative movement of American Judaism, which is until recently the largest denomination of American Judaism, and it's kind of the we're kind of the moderates. The name is a bit of a misnomer since we're not really the most conservative of American Jews. We're sort of in between the Reform on the left and the Orthodox on the right. And I was very involved in my Jewish community as a young adult. I kind of drifted away a little, as many do during college, and actually came back to a stricter form of Jewish observance right after college.
You were really practicing Orthodoxy?
I was. I'm not sure if I ever really adopted the label, since I'm not too big on any of these denominational labels, but my practice was certainly Orthodox. I was wearing a kippah all the time, for example, and very strictly observing the dietary laws, keeping kosher, and so on. And you know, I titled the book God versus Gay not just because it's a clever alliteration, but because it was really a dichotomy that I felt very deeply for at least 10 years of my adult life.
As a gay man yourself.
As a gay man myself, exactly, and living in what's sometimes called the closet. You know, and I think I joked when I was visiting in Illinois that the closet's a very cozy metaphor. You know, as a gay man, I kind of like my closet. You know, my shoes, my clothes, and all those kinds of things are there. But the real closet is a place made out of lies. And, you know, it's mind-boggling where I sit now to imagine a loving God or a religion that prides itself on love, wanting people to lie and distort themselves in such a horrible way. It's interesting. I was just, I was on the a radio show just a few days ago, but it was a one of the AM radio far right talk radio shows, like a pretty far right actually. And one of the things I say in the book is that the first flaw in the story of creation is that it's not good for the human being to be alone, which tells us how important love is and intimacy is. And my host then interrupted and said, "It's great for humans to be alone. We should all be alone." And I think that, you know, that was the beginning of an hour-long conversation. It really set the tone that if we really believe that the path to holiness is one of suffering and distorting the self, that just feels to me like a very different spiritual path from the one that I've found so nurturing all these years.
Now, your own spiritual path has been an interesting one. Tell us about how you went from Yale Law School to Hebrew Union to study, of all things, New Testament.
That's right. Yeah, I sometimes joke that I'm a nice Jewish boy gone bad. I did go to law school and am trained as a lawyer, which actually has come in very you know, it's been central to the work I've been doing on the on this case, this Darun Ravi case, sort of commenting on it in the last few weeks. But I was always drawn to spirituality, what some would call mysticism, and for many years, so I did study New Testament as, for my master's degree, and I'm just now finishing my PhD in Jewish thought, where I've specialized in Jewish mysticism and in Kabbalah. You know, ironically, it wasn't really until I started a Buddhist meditation practice in my 30s that I suddenly understood a little bit the Jewish mystical texts and practices that I'd been learning about for the previous 10 years. Primarily as an academic. You know, I sometimes feel like meditation gave me the answer key to my Jewish practice and really enabled me to kind of open my heart a little bit and to really explore some of the deeper meanings of these spiritual traditions.
And how would you categorize yourself today?
Trans everything, I'd say. I don't identify with a particular denomination. I have a very rich Jewish practice, and my Dharma practice, my Buddhist practice, is also essential to me. I'm someone who feels very much at home in multiple religious contexts. I was just this morning at the Ethical Culture Society, which is kind of a little bit like Unitarian Universalism, although similar but different. I feel very comfortable in places where folks are coming together across boundary lines and not erasing that which is different, because I think that's very valuable, but celebrating the differences while striving for something that transcends all of them.
Now, you lived for a while in Israel. Tell us how that came about.
So, I lived in Israel for 3 years. That was when I became more religious right after college, and, you know, it's a wonderful kind of Jewish version of pilgrimage. A lot of folks go either before or after university. A lot of Americans and Europeans go, and it's our first time being in an immersive Jewish environment, and I spent my time learning in a traditional Jewish yeshiva, learning academy. I'm also doing my graduate work, so I always had one foot in, one foot out. But that was really a special time in my life, and it was really formative. I think I really realized my previous book, which is called Everything is God, The Radical Path of Non-Dual Judaism, was a lot about this dual or multiple spiritual path that I've kind of created for myself. And it was at that early time, I mean, we're now almost 20 years ago practically, that I really understood the value of having what might be called a Jewish heart or a Jewish soul. I think my brain is very much a Buddhist brain and a scientific brain, and I don't have a lot of beliefs in the supernatural or in dogma or any of those kinds of things, but there is something that's in me that resonates with these particular folkways that I grew up with as a child.
Now, in spite of your strong academic background and current involvement in PhD work, the book you wrote is not an academic book. It's a popular book. It's written for people from many different religious traditions to read and think about, and the kind of issues you raise and the ways you raise them I found very engaging. And I come from a Christian background. I'm a Protestant pastor. But I found you know the New Testament well as the Hebrew Scriptures. You bring in material from many different faith traditions.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me. Of course, I was very nervous, you know, working with the New Testament, even though I'm pretty familiar with it as a series of texts and academic background. That's different from, you know, having it really be part of my spiritual tradition. So I did spend a long time doing that work. And, you know, it's interesting what you said about it not being an academic work, which is true. That was the ambition, was to write something more accessible. Part of me really wanted to write kind of the fun stuff, you know, maybe queer theology in a Jewish perspective or something about sexuality and mysticism. And one day I may write one of those books. But I started a national LGBT Jewish organization called Nehirim. It's Nehirim. And it's a half-invented word. It really means lights. And, you know, every week I get an email from someone who is at square one of their own journey of reconciling sexuality and religion. Maybe it's someone from a traditional background whose family has disowned them, or maybe someone not even from such a traditional background but who's still really struggling with this perceived dichotomy. And I just felt that there was still there was a real space or a real need for making the positive case, not just that, well, you know, these six bad verses out of 31,000 in the Bible, you know, don't really mean what they seem, but to actually say something more than that, which is that, as you said earlier, that our shared religious values support equality, that religious people should support equality and inclusion for LGBT folks because of religion, not despite it. Not that it should be some compromise between religion and our other values, and also not that this is just an issue for the, whether it's 5% or 10% or whatever, those of us who happen to identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, but for all of us, that this is one of the defining questions of our time. And if we see ourselves as engaged with religion and religious thinking and religious communities, that this is one of the signal issues of our moment, regardless of where we identify on a spectrum of sexuality and gender. And I hope I've achieved that. It's been really gratifying over the last several months, kind of crisscrossing the country and meeting a lot of folks, the most surprising along the way has been meeting a lot of parents of kids who came out as gay or lesbian, and the parents had not maybe given this issue a whole lot of thought, and then all of a sudden it became a central one for them. And if I can, someone once said that good religion comforts the afflicted and afflicts the comfortable, and if I can do a little of that, that's I've achieved any goal I could have had for the book.
You mentioned in your book the organization PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, as an organization that helps publicize that.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful organization, and there's some really heartrending literature that's come out in movies now. Also, there's a book called Prayers for Bobby, for example, of a woman who was a relatively conservative Christian and her son, who was gay, ended up killing himself tragically, and she kind of realized too late that the role that she had played in her own son's suffering. And there's so many stories, most of which are not too late, of stories of parents coming around. And actually, it's kind of funny. When I came out, now it's about 10, 15 years ago. My mother, who's now in her 70s, was not immediately receptive. It wasn't the news that she wanted to hear from her son. And to her credit, she's gone on a real journey, actually, over the last 10 years. And she danced at my wedding in September, and she's been truly an advocate and just the kind of parent that any gay kid would dream of having. And it's funny, in this last, we started talking about the article about the Darun Ravi case. She sent me an email criticizing me from the pro-gay side, that I shouldn't be defending the homophobic bully. So that just shows how far that we can go on that kind of a journey.
For our listeners, we're talking again with Jay Michelson, who's the author of God versus Gay? The Religious Case for Equality, published by Beacon Press just last year. I might just mention what the outline of the book is. It's, as you say, very affirmative. It's a positive book. You start off with why our fundamental values support rather than oppose equality for sexual minorities, for gay, lesbian, transgendered folks. Part two, that section, is called What the Bad Verses, in this case you're talking about in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, really say about homosexuality. Then in part three, why the inclusion of sexual minorities is good, not bad, for religious values. Let's start off with talking a bit about, you say the most fundamental message of Western religion is to choose life, and you quote from the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Torah in the Jewish scriptures, but it's also accepted by Muslims, by Christians as scripture. Why do you start there?
Well, I feel like it is a fundamental place to begin. If we believe that life is a gift, then any wasting of that life, whether it's in a strong case like killing or murder, or whether it's in the case of someone not fulfilling or not having the opportunity to live a full and rich life, and whether that's because of discrimination or poverty or injustice or any other reason, it feels to me like that's got to be the starting point. I mean, if we still view that, you know, our lives are just to be sacrificed in the name of something else. You know, to me, that's a kind of a religion of death. And I don't mean in cases of, you know, values and giving one's life for a purpose, obviously. I mean, you know, abasing ourselves in the name of some particular misunderstanding. You know, it's hard to argue with someone who says, well, of course, a gay person should just deny themselves any access to intimacy or any access to love. But if we believe that it is upon us to choose life, and that's whether we consider ourselves religious or not, or however we intersect with our spiritual traditions, that to me feels just like it's a fundamental yes, to say yes to life and to love and to the miracle of what it is to be human. And so that's one of the places I start. I do also start in Genesis with it's not good to be alone, which I think is a fundamental value. And all of these, you know, sometimes if I could just kind of build this out for a moment.
Sure.
There's sometimes this mistake, like I said before, focusing on the clobber text, on the six verses which allegedly say something about same-sex intimacy. But those texts are marginal and they're ambiguous. And, you know, the dirty little secret is that they can be interpreted 10 ways from Sunday. I mean, it's not hard to interpret Leviticus in a way that's very liberating, that has nothing to do with gay or lesbian people. And I don't want to say that it's a game, but it's close to it. It's not a serious religious or theological move to go with one interpretation and to come up with one interpretation or another. What is serious and what's actually much more interesting and important and the kind of conversation I wish we could have in our public square is to decide what values we have that cause us to take one interpretation or another. That is to say, it's not the language game, it's the decision, which is a serious ethical decision, of how to approach a text or a tradition, and what are the values that guide that choice. And so it's for that reason that I start on some of these more positive traditions, rather than, you know, go right into the etymology of the Greek word paraphysin, which I do eventually, as you know. But that question is really secondary, and the primary question is what values guide this kind of investigation.
Let me encourage listeners to join our conversation. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL in the 217 area code. If you're listening long distance, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. We're being broadcast right now at WILL 580 AM as well as 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. And it's being heard also online, live at will.illinois.edu/AM. If you missed part of this program, you can listen to the podcast at your convenience. It'll be up in a day or two, or at least in a week. And you can go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Leave the G off of keeping, and you'll see the list of all of our recent programs and be able to listen to this on whatever device you prefer. We have literally thousands of downloads every week here at WILL, and I'm happy to say that this Keeping the Faith program has many interesting guests who get heard for weeks and months and years to come. So it's a great advantage to live when we do with the kind of technological advances that have been made. Our guest today again is Jay Michelson, talking about God versus gay. Jay, when you came out publicly, you talked about your family's reaction. How did your peers react? People you'd been in school with who may not have had any sense that you were gay.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Yeah, I think I'll back up a little bit, which was my fear was that it was really going to be the end of everything. It was going to be the end of my religious life, the end of my community, the end of my friends. And the reality was actually 180 degrees the opposite of that. Actually coming out, I think, was the beginning of my spiritual life, my religious life as I know it now. And I know actually a few friends of mine are listening in now who knew me when, you know, knew me 25 years ago when I was in college. And I think hopefully I've gotten a little bit more relaxed since then. And, you know, the reaction at the time was almost uniformly positive. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a cliche to say so, but if your friends are worth anything, they want you to be happy. And this was, you know, I was concerned because I'd basically been lying to them for 10 years. And, of course, there's that awkwardness, you know, and there's a change and there's a shift. And it's not that everything goes on as it did before, but I have to say the response, even of some of my more traditionally religious friends, was overwhelmingly positive. And I'm sure there are, you know, may have been a couple who kind of dropped away at that time, but I felt very, you know, whatever awkwardness there was, and there was some awkwardness at the time, it was so outweighed by having this huge weight off of my shoulders. You know, it's kind of a glib analogy, but as I've been on tour, I've been analogizing it to that movie, The Sixth Sense, where this is where the kid sees the dead people, and the dead people don't realize that they're dead, and they're just kind of walking around like they're walking around as ghosts, but they think they're still alive. And that really was my experience during a lot of that time in the closet. I just had no idea how much I was carrying around until I put it down.
You talk about the ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments being that we should not bear false witness, and you mentioned that being in the closet is basically lying.
Of course. I mean, it's a lie that just perpetuates itself, and it's one on top of another on top of another. You know, a lot of folks on the, I would say, the far right want to say that sexual orientation is just about sex. You know, it's just like lust, basically. But that's not true. It's about love, right? And when we lie about how we are looking for love in the world, or how we see the world, or how we feel about people, we're not just lying about what we do in the bed. You know, we're in the bedroom. We're lying about an essential part of our souls. And so, again, for me, I think I didn't realize at the time how much of this kind of ambient stress and tension that I was carrying around all the time. And that makes it sound like, you know, almost like too trivial, like, well, I was stressed and now I'm relaxed. I mean, it was really pain that I was carrying around all of the time. And I just didn't realize that was optional and not mandatory.
You mentioned further on in the book that there are some feminist critics who look at the coming out issue very differently than gay men do. You quote Virginia Raimi Mollenkott, who talks about the feminine response of being a trickster or a schemer as sort of an alternative to that.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up, because I you know, whenever I talk about coming out, I try to put an asterisk next to it, that it's not a universal LGBT experience. A lot of people experience their sexuality as fluid. A lot of people, it's less about a once and forever coming out and more about a kind of moving back and forth. And exactly as Mollenkott writes about, for many people, you know, coming out is a privilege, and it depends on a certain power, position of power, that many people don't have. You know, listeners might be, hopefully will be, shocked to learn that in the last few years, LGBT youth homelessness has gone up rather than down. And that's because kids are coming out earlier and earlier, you know, thanks to pop culture and things like that. And they're often getting thrown out of their homes by religious parents and ending up on the streets and in very high-risk situations, often as sex workers. It's a really tragic situation, and it comes from the fact that it's not always possible to come out. It's not always even wise to come out. And I think, you know, in my own life, I make decisions. You know, we don't always have to be totally transparent about everything. There is such a thing as privacy, and so it's always finding that space where it's safe enough to come out and empowering to do so. But it has been really interesting, you know, in the work that I've done with Nahirim, with that organization, working with a lot of transgender folks who are not so interested in coming out. You know, some are and some aren't. Some transgender folks are interested in passing as their gender, their true gender, and they're not interested in letting everybody know that they happen to be transgender. And it's actually not, you know, the whole notion of coming out is one which actually doesn't necessarily operate for everyone. And so I've learned a lot, I think, during this these last few years of doing this work, that, you know, if there's one thing, you, people kind of hate the LGBT acronym, and it actually has gotten much longer. It's an LGBTIQA acronym, and the letters keep adding on. And people make fun of that, but one thing the acronym is meant to teach us is that there's no set of assumptions that can capture the complexity of what it is to be human. And that, for me, is a lesson that I'm happy to relearn every day.
I mentioned that your book is not primarily academic in tone or style. It reads easily, but you do have a lot of facts here, a lot of results of scientific studies, sociological studies, psychological studies, even ethnographic studies. You mentioned in your book, for example, that less than half of the LGBT folks live openly today in terms of being out to their friends and family.
And that's true even now. You know, that's true even now in our time. You can imagine what the numbers were like earlier. And it's a daunting thing. You know, I think we all, the folks who are listening probably can resonate with the idea of being on a journey, you know, spiritual journey or some other kind. And when you're on a journey, you progress, you move forward. And you don't always stay at step one. And it can be really, it can be disheartening, but it's also, for me, kind of, it gives me a certain kind of inspiration to remember that so many folks are still at square one. You know, and I hear also a lot of times, let's say from the more progressive folks who I talk to, who are either religious and progressive or who are not especially religious, you know, the question of, you know, why should we even worry about this? You know, why should we spend time with trying to engage, you know, bigots and homophobes and talk about the Bible and these kinds of questions? And, you know, I resonate with I can see where that's coming from, but that critique. But at the same time, you know, that's a very privileged position to be able to have. You know, it's not possible for some lesbian teenager who's living in a very difficult situation in her home life to get over the Bible. And, you know, I often try to ask that question that activists ask, you know, who is the we when we're talking about all of us, if we're all over the Bible or if we're all past this issue? To me, the we does include those LGBT youth, homeless youth, and it does include people who are in difficult situations. And that's why, even for those of us who have moved beyond it, for whom, you know, this whole issue of sexual diversity is no big deal, I really do feel that we have a responsibility to enter into real conversations with folks who aren't there yet, not because they're necessarily bigoted or backward, but because this is new for many people. And for those of us who are, you know, sometimes it feels like when I've been on tour, I'm preaching to the choir. But that's because it should be choir practice, you know, to kind of inspire other folks to have these kinds of conversations. And, you know, maybe we know someone in North Carolina or in Maryland, which are two of the states, or in Minnesota, which are states that are debating various forms of same-sex marriage, or actually, in the case of North Carolina, of moving backward on the issue of same-sex relationships. Maybe there are people in our families with whom, you know, we don't really feel like stirring it up, but this is one of those issues, and there are others, but this is one of those issues where it's worth having, I think, the difficult conversations, because that's the only way that we're going to dislodge some of these preconceptions and assumptions that we really need to work on.
We're about halfway through our hour-long interview this Sunday afternoon with Jay Michelson, author of God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, that came out just last year from Beacon Press. He's also the author of last week's Newsweek, March 19, 2012, full-page article, Can Suicide Be a Hate Crime? He was interviewed this morning on CBS News. We're happy to have him on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. Next week, we'll be talking with Professor Esther Portnoy about her recent trip to Kenya and learn about school safe zones there. That's March 25th. Sunday, April 1st, our guest will be Jackie Lynn, who is National Executive Director of the Episcopal Peace Foundation. April 8th, Josh Slocum will be our guest. He's the Executive Director of the National Funeral Consumers Association of America, talking about how funeral costs, burial costs, can be reduced. April 15, we'll be talking about earth care with Reverend Dr. Catherine Cusmall and David Sherwood from the First Presbyterian Church of Urbana. Then on April 22nd, we have a very special archive program. Roger Ebert talked with us about religious themes in movies back in 1999, before his very first Overlooked Film Festival here in Urbana-Champaign at the University of Illinois, where he was a graduate and editor of the Daily Illini newspaper, and went on to be one of the, I guess, the most famous film critic, Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic. He's lost his voice due to throat cancer and hasn't been able to speak for 3 or 4 years. But we recently found this long-lost archive recording, and we're going to be replaying it on April 22nd. It's still quite relevant because he talks about some films that are really classics, and so it'll be good to hear Roger Ebert's voice again. That'll be April 22nd. Coming up at the University YMCA, one of the supporters for Keeping the Faith over the years, the next Friday Forum will not be till after spring break. That'll start up again March 30th. Can globalization promote human rights? Rhoda Howard-Hassman will be the speaker. She's the Canadian Research Chair in International Human Rights. That's at the University YMCA on Wright Street, corner of Wright and Chalmers in Champaign, right opposite Lincoln Hall. These are free lectures at noon at the Y, as part of the series this semester on creative approaches to global development. Well, let's get back to our guest, Jay Michelson. And again, let me give the phone numbers again. I see we have a caller that looks like we're about to be able to talk to. 217-333-9455 is local number. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. And again, remember, podcasts can be listened to at your convenience at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Let's go to a caller on line number one. Yes, you're on the air with our guest, Jay Michelson.
I'm glad to be able to talk with you, Mr. Michelson. As a gay man, I agree with your mother that I would say several people were responsible for Clemente's death, and I would say that, first of all, the university held a responsibility for not following up on his, you know, contacting them. Also, I don't know whether I read the New Yorker article, but I haven't read your book, but the situation was that, you know, he even went public with a blog or site called Just Us Boys, where he asked for advice on what to do. I think he really felt bereft. And there was a situation where this Dharam Ravi had an arrogance, a hubris, where he thought that what this person was doing was beneath what he expected of human beings. And so thus he had the right to ridicule him, to show his disgust. And then when he was found out, he tried to cover his tracks, remove his tweets and all of that. And so, you know, I'm glad he got what he got. And I hope that it sets a standard. Because I remember there was a homosexual poet by the name of W.H. Auden, who wrote a poem called For the Time Being, and he states the existential view that the kitchen table exists because I scrub it. Any comments?
Sure. Yeah, no, I appreciate what you have to say on that. I think, again, you know, I mentioned early on that it's not really a question of whether just responsibility or guilt. You know, being charged with a hate crime is a very specific kind of a charge. So, you know, if we're talking about responsibility, I'm in agreement with you. If we're talking about arrogance, I'm definitely in agreement with you. The jury did also find Dharun Ravi guilty of obstructing justice by deleting that tweet, and I'm in full agreement with that. There's no question of that. You know, but if we take a little bit of the bigger picture here, you know, you probably know very well as I do that, you know, hate crimes legislation is a little bit delicate. And there are those who say that there should be no hate crimes legislation protection rather for sexual orientation, and because I think this was such a weak case, because this was not an act of violence, the case was not about the suicide, the case was about the spying which led to the suicide, but the act itself was not violent, and the motives were so unclear that this case could end up weakening hate crimes protection for those who are the most vulnerable moving forward. So, you know, even apart from the justice effects on Dharun Ravi himself, which I think are the most important, there is also the second question about what the effect this is going to have on hate crimes legislation around the country. So, you know, I feel on this one it's maybe it's clear from my tone and I think from yours as well that I don't feel like a sharp disagreement with you on this. I think the territory I'm staking out is one of uncertainty, that it just feels to me as though this is not the kind of clear-cut case that we usually see in hate crimes. I think about, again, like Matthew Shepard or something like that. And for that reason, there's just a lot of ambiguity. Not every locker room, you know, slight homophobe is guilty of a hate crime. And it seemed to me, based on my review of the evidence that was in the case, that, you know, that this is someone like that.
What if it had been a heterosexual couple who he disliked their activity, and he had done the same thing to them, and one of them had committed suicide?
No,
would that not be a hate crime because of his action?
No, of course not. No, I mean, that's not a hate crime. To be a hate crime is a very specific charge, and it has to be the action, whatever it is, you know, has to be motivated by a desire to target the victim, based on a protected characteristic, and that characteristic could be race, it could be sexual orientation, and so forth. And
but it was,
you know,
sexual orientation.
So the question was, in this case, so he was clearly spying, he was clearly invading privacy. Was he doing that with the intention of targeting his roommate because of his sexual orientation? And that is actually a very difficult question. So in the case that you've just put forward, if it was a heterosexual roommate, so heterosexuality is not a protected characteristic in terms of the hate crimes legislation. So
but the action they were involved in that the person might disagree with, and thus his video webcasting it would have, you know, brought about the same thing with spying.
Right, Steve, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this. I mean, I think, again, the action has to be motivated by a very specific intent, you know, for it to qualify as a hate crime. Now, actually, the fact is in New Jersey has one of the strictest hate crimes laws in the country. And the truth of it is that if Tyler Clemente himself felt targeted because of his sexual orientation, that could also be sufficient ground. So if you look carefully at the way that the jury returned the verdict, they had no doubt that based on the verdict that they returned, that Tyler Clemente felt targeted. That was absolutely clear, and was clear to all of us. What they divided on, and it depended on, you know, they got into the details of which count they found him guilty of, what they divided on was whether that was Ravi's actual intention. And, you know, so being a jerk is definitely not good behavior, and it's definitely not pro-gay behavior, and it's definitely condemnable and contemptible. So it to me, it's all of those things. But
and
is it,
what do you
a,
do?
Is it actually
slap
a hate
him on the wrist and say, hey, you know, you're young, you're arrogant, you're full of hubris. Just go on and live your life. Too bad about what happened, but go on.
Let me do interrupt here. I appreciate the caller's perspective, and I think we've heard it. I do want to get us back to talking about the book, and which is a more general issue. We are, of course, talking with with Jay Michelson, who's author of God Versus Gay, who also did write this article just last week in Newsweek about the Dharan Ravi case that led to the suicide of the Rutgers student who was gay. And that is very current news, but I think the book gets at some very important issues that I want to have time to talk about, and we are down to our last 10 minutes or so. Could I ask you, Jay, to talk a little bit, please? I do thank the caller for raising those issues, and I think his perspective was heard. Jay, can we talk a little bit about the second section of your book? I know it's the negative part more so, although you certainly put a positive spin on when you look at the various passages in the Hebrew Bible and the Christian New Testament that some people think prohibit any kind of gay sex.
Sure. Yeah. So, as we mentioned before, you know, this is that second question. So, and the answer to the first question of what are our values shapes how we look at the second question. So, for example, if we agree that multiple interpretations are possible, and I think factually there's no choice but to agree, because obviously there are multiple interpretations possible. You know, if we're a Martian dropped on the text, we have no way of evaluating between those multiple interpretations. But we're not Martians, right? So we're reading the text in the context of suffering, of the Tyler Clementis of the world, in the context of fundamental values, like it's not good to be alone or choose life and so forth. And so the guiding principle is that the liberating readings, the ones that lead to more love and to more life and to more justice, don't really need to win. They just need to tie. And so it's with that in mind, I do then in the book proceed to look at all of those clobber texts. You know, for example, the story of Sodom, which has nothing to do with consensual homosexuality. It's a story about rape and the humiliation of strangers, and it was widely understood by other texts in the Bible itself as being about the sin of Sodom, as being about stinginess and cruelty and
lack of hospitality.
Exactly. And you know, sodomy is really should be translated as oppression. It's not actually about sex acts. And turning to Leviticus, we find that it's actually a very limited prohibition connected to idolatry, sexual ritual in the context of Canaanite ritual practice, which, you know, doesn't play a huge role in the personal lives of too many gay men and lesbians today. And when we turn to the New Testament, to Paul in Romans and in Corinthians, we find that these actually aren't prohibitions at all, but are rather discussions of societies, pagan societies in Rome and in Corinth. And when Paul says something, he uses a Greek word, paraphysian, which is translated usually as unnatural, but which doesn't mean natural in the sense of science at all. Paul's not interested in science. He's interested in morality in terms of ethics. And what he's really complaining about is relationships in which the man does not always dominate the woman. And for him, any society that doesn't subjugate women to men and doesn't subjugate the body to the spirit is not a society to listen to. And that's true for him, for the Romans and the Corinthians as well. So, you know, each of these texts, read separately or read together, can be understood in a variety of ways. And I think it's very easy for those of us, even those of us who are progressives, to say, well, yeah, the Bible prohibits homosexuality, but, you know, why listen to the Bible? Or we don't take the Bible literally. And I actually don't want to go down any of those roads, even though I'm receptive to them. I don't want to take that approach because it gives away too much. You know, there are folks who are really committed to a very particular reading of a scriptural tradition or of a religious tradition. And for us to tell them, you have to give up your whole worldview in order for there to be space for us to coexist, that for me is too much. And I want to be able to say, well, that's, you know, we may disagree as to whether the Bible is inerrant and, you know, whether it's a creation of human beings or of God. We may disagree about that, but we can agree about its own internal fundamental values, perhaps. And on the basis of that, we can find a space not just for coexistence, but for celebration of sexual diversity.
You list your website as nehirim.org, nehirim.org. Listeners can go there and can actually communicate with you directly?
Well, they can communicate with me directly on jmichelson.net, actually, okay. Which is my personal website. Nehirim.org is the organization's. But the easiest place to find me, actually, is on Facebook. I have a so-called fan page there. It always makes me self-conscious to say that. But if you just search J. Michelson under Facebook, that's the easiest place where I'm in touch with readers from all sides and all spectrums, all sides of the spectrum on these issues.
And again, J. Michelson is spelled J-A-Y and then M-I-C-H-A-E-L-S-O-N. J. Michelson, author of God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. In the third section of your book, Jay, you give a lot of helpful information, a lot of bibliographical information, many pages of books you recommend and articles and further reading, as well as lists of people that you've personally found helpful, not only within your own Jewish tradition, but within Buddhism and Christianity. Why'd you take that approach?
Well, I really thank you for noticing it, actually. I really did want to have a book that's useful even to people who don't agree with me, you know, and which is to say, you know, there are really fascinating books, some of them large and some of them small, from a variety of different religious perspectives on the same issue. And you know, one of the books that that I recommend in the bibliography from an evangelical perspective begins with a sort of declaration of faith.
I mean, an evangelical Christian perspective.
Evangelical Christian right. perspective. He says, you know, I am a Bible-believing evangelical Christian who believes that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, and proceeds from there. You know, and for folks who are operating in that kind of a faith community, that book may be better to give to their parents than God Versus Gay. I mean, I hate to discourage anyone from buying the book, but it may well be that because it speaks from that particular audience, it can actually be more helpful. And, you know, I speak also from a male perspective. There are a lot of really good books that have been written by women, a lot of good books that have been written by folks who are transgender. So I wanted to throw as much in there as possible so that it could be as useful to as wide a range of people as possible. And in the book, I should point out, you know, I do try to find values common to Judaism and Christianity, but I don't spend a lot of time on Islam. I don't spend a lot of time on non-Western religions. And even the ones that are part of my own spiritual path, I don't talk about a lot in this book. And so I think it's really... It can be really powerful for folks to just realize that, you know, there's an LGBT Mormon organization out there, for example, or you know, there's an LGBT Assembly of God organization out there, and that for all of these different denominations and faith communities, there are folks who are refusing the dichotomy, not just, you know, let's say ex-Mormons, people who have left, which I also respect, but folks who are still in the church and who are still, you know, believing and working to reform their own religious community.
And on that line, let's talk a little bit about the largest Christian denomination, Roman Catholicism, and the issues you raise about pedestry, but also the organization called Dignity.
That's right. Yeah, it's, of all of the traditions, the larger traditions, I think, actually, you know, the Catholic Church is the most difficult because, you know, a lot of what's in the book are ways for individuals to understand their traditions, whether it's a scriptural tradition or, you know, or part of their religious tradition. But, you know, in not every religion are folks empowered to do that. You know, it may not. If so, for example, in my own Jewish tradition, you know, Orthodox Jews can think what they want about the text, but they're not the people empowered. Individual Orthodox Jews are not the ones empowered to decide what the law is for Jews. In the Orthodox Jewish world, that's only up to Orthodox rabbis. And the Catholic Church is a little bit similar. You know, but it is striking that the huge gap between the church hierarchy itself and Catholic folks in the pews. You know, and it's really remarkable on a wide range of political issues, and on ethical moral issues as well. And this is one of those. So, Dignity is an LGBT Catholic group that's been working in a number of forms, you know, partly to create a space of shelter and safety so that gay Catholics can be honest about who they are and still take communion and still, you know, participate in the rites of the church. And secondly, to do as much advocacy as is possible, and it's a really challenging time right now. Obviously, the Pope is very conservative and extremely, I'll just say, preoccupied with issues of homosexuality for reasons that, you know, that he himself knows. And it's very difficult right now for a lot of friends of mine who are Catholic and who are really not seeing a lot of hope from the church hierarchy. But at the same time, there's just been a real revolution, I would say, among ordinary Catholics in the pews. Not that everybody thinks the same, but there's a real understanding of the instability or the sense of crisis around the current dogma. And, you know, if I could say just one more thing about that, you know, for those of us who are in the choir, so to speak, and those of us who are, engaged or potentially engaged in conversations with folks who are still really struggling with the issue or are a little bit more conservative, I often tell people that for me, a lot of my mission is just to create a sense of crisis, just to get the sense across that there's a problem. You know, that if you have this very traditional reading of texts, you know, that existed before we know what we know today about sexuality, that dates back to a much earlier time. You know, you've got a crisis. It's just like when if you had a view that the Bible says that, which the Bible does, basically, that the earth is flat and has four corners, that leads to a crisis, you know, and you've got to find a way to work through that. And, you know, I may not convince all, you know, conservative religious folks of my solution to the crisis, but if I can just get them to kind of see that there is a crisis, then they can start doing some of that work for themselves. And I think that's a lot of where a lot of the activism in the Catholic Church is right now. Obviously, there's certainly a crisis you know, with the sexual abuse scandals in the Church itself. But I mean the inability for the Church to fulfill its own mission to minister to the needs of its own people. And, you know, I do actually feel, and it's good that we come to this point kind of towards the end, I think notwithstanding all of the rancor around this issue, and it can be pretty bruising at times, I actually feel optimistic about the way that we've moved so quickly on this issue in our country, but even more importantly on the value of this debate for spiritual and religious communities. You know, if we do consider ourselves religious, surely we should welcome the opportunity to reflect and to expand the conscience and to ask some of these really difficult questions about, you know, really fundamental things, you know, religion, sexuality, because that's what religious people should be doing. You know, this is the kind of question that we should be asking and that we grow as a result of asking. That, you know, the philosophical life or the religious life that I understand, that I can respect, is not one of easy answers to easy questions. It's one where difficult questions are asked, and that's how we grow as human beings.
We are going to have to stop there. We are out of time. We've been talking with author J. Michelson. His book is God Versus Gay, with a question mark, The Religious Case for Equality, published by Beacon Press, came out just in 2011. If you missed part of this program, do download the podcast, listen to it at your convenience from will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, we'll be talking with Professor Esther Portnoy about school safe zones in Kenya. The week following, with Jackie Lynn, who is head of the Episcopal Peace Foundation in the United States. April 8th, Josh Slocum, the executive director of the National Funeral Consumers Association. Further on, we'll be talking with Axel Gehrman from the Unitarian Universalist Church, Catherine Kusmaul from the Presbyterian, both in Urbana, Joan Bailey, some of the guests coming up on Keeping the Faith. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580.